Well, now to the secrets given up by a recently unearthed 600-year-old Kōmura pit near Dunedin and how archaeological science lines up with Mātauraka Māori, Māori knowledge and oral history. Some groundbreaking research has dated Kōmura in New Zealand back to the 15th century. The ancient Kōmura pits just north of Dunedin at Purakanui are also the most southerly ever to be discovered in Polynesia. The find is valuable to local Māori, shedding light on how this taonga was stored over half a millennium ago, and confirming local Māori stories, knowledge and place names that foretold what the researchers confirmed. Our guests, chairperson of Purakanui Block, Nicola Taylor, and Associate Professor Ian Barber from the University of Otago's Archaeology Program, which has just published this research in Science Journal PLOS One. He explains what's been found.
What we have here is the confirmation, as far as we can by the science, of the presence of storage pits excavated for Kōmura in the 15th century in Otago, in a location that is over 200 kilometres south of the otherwise accepted limit of the southern storage of live Kōmura roots. And this has been found in the form of storage pit outlines that were excavated into a midden site, and when I say excavated in the past, until we then re-excavated them about 20 years ago in the course of a field school that was taking place at this midden site at Purakanui. And as we did so, expecting really that we would only find midden remains, which were perfectly sufficient for the training purposes that we were taking, that we were undertaking. But in the course of that training exercise, we encountered these pits. And I continued work thereafter into the first decade of the 20th century. Then our excavation came to a conclusion. And at that time, we really didn't have either the funding or the science to allow us to adequately say either how old the pits were or what they were used for. We had some indications from starch granules preserved in the base of the pits that they may have been for crops, but we needed more work and more funding to be able to confirm that. So over the last 10 years, I've had the benefit of further funding, most particularly from a Marsden Award that was provided to investigate marginal agriculture in the Polynesian past in Aotearoa. So those funds and new scientific techniques, both in radiocarbon and also in microbotanical remains, what we've been able to do is to identify crop remains from the very base of these pits fairly conclusively as sweet potato, these tiny distinctive starch granules have all of the attributes of sweet potato. And just as significantly, we've been able to radiocarbon date the pits using new statistical modelling. And that allows us to basically report a chronology of for pit construction and use of 1430 to 1460 CE, which is one of the most precise radiocarbon dates for a particular event or feature ever reported in Polynesian archaeology. So we're pretty excited about that. So that allows us
to... Yeah, well, I was going to say, why is it so significant to date the pit and specifically to date it as a kōmura, as the food? Why is that so significant in the course of what we know?
Sure, that's a great question. So there are two responses to that. The first is that the dating is important because theoretically this pit could have been constructed in the 19th century. So it was clearly a part of the archaeological fabric, part of the archaeological site. But without radiocarbon dating, we just don't know whether or not that feature was excavated hundreds of years ago, or say 200 years ago. Māori, as Nikki, I'm sure, will be able to talk more about, we're living in Pūrākanui in the 19th century and still through to the present day, as in Nikki's case. So we needed to know whether or not this had been a modern feature or a relatively modern feature, as in contemporary, near contemporary times, or whether in fact it was hundreds of years old. If it was a modern feature, it could theoretically have been used to store potatoes, for example, white potato, and there's nothing terribly remarkable about that. So the radiocarbon dating has allowed us to determine that these pit features, which were constructed in the very form of Rua Kumara, the Kumara stores, were 15th century. So that's quite exciting, just in terms of knowing, you know, that this technology was down here in the south hundreds of years ago. The second aspect of the dating is that it also relates to a larger debate in Polynesian archaeology as to when sweet potato actually arrived into Polynesia and down here in Aotearoa. So there have been ongoing suggestions that perhaps sweet potato, which ultimately comes from the Americas, arrived into the Pacific as a result of Spanish explorers or Hispanic exploration. And in fact, we know that that is the case in the Papua New Guinea highlands, where sweet potato is there most definitely is a very important crop now, but as a consequence of a Hispanic introduction. And there are only a handful of really securely dated archaeological remains of sweet potato throughout Polynesia pre-Columbian, so pre the time the Spanish could have brought those sweet potato into the Pacific, theoretically. So this find now joins that small handful to indicate that indeed sweet potato was here in Polynesia. It was introduced. We still don't know exactly by whom, whether by Polynesians travelling to the Americas or by someone from America coming into Polynesia. But certainly we know that one of those things occurred to bring sweet potato here, to be down here at Pūrākanui in the 15th century.
Had there been a theory that it could somehow have arrived naturally, or is the work now going to focus more on who and how and when, and what would progress that, Ian?
Yeah, there are still botanists and other scientists who have argued, including fairly recently, for natural introduction. One botanical study, for example, published just within the last couple of years, has suggested, looking at the genetics of sweet potato, that the Polynesian sweet potato seems to have been isolated for some time and probably much longer than would be allowed for in an argument of human introduction. But I think one of the problems with those sorts of arguments is that we know so little about the original sweet potato that came here into the Pacific. So soon after contact, populations across Polynesia, including Aotearoa, basically adopted new crops. And in the case of New Zealand Māori, for example, new varieties of sweet potato, hardier varieties of sweet potato, brought down here and stopped cultivating the original varieties. So we actually don't know a lot about the genetics of the original varieties. What we do know is from ethnographic descriptions, particularly from Hawaii, where there was seemingly some considerable number of varieties, that there may well have been, a number of different varieties of sweet potato. And so the genetics of the original sweet potato that arrived in Polynesia, in short, are very difficult to recover from evidence today. Okay. And that would be my critique, I guess, of the argument for natural introduction. Whereas the argument for cultural introduction is that along the coast of South America, there are names for sweet potato, traditional names among a number of indigenous peoples that are clearly related to the Polynesian name Kumara or Umara. So those are names like Kumala or Umara, and they're very, very similar to the names of the sweet potato in Polynesia. And that, to me, is a very compelling argument for a cultural introduction.
Ngā mihi, Ian. Stay with us. Ian Barber, Nicola Taylor, kia ora, if I can bring you in now. First, this land, it's so beautiful. Anyone who has been to Porakanui does not need to be told that. But tell us more about the significance of this land and obviously now the very rich archaeological history.
Yes. Well, Ian's touched on, you know, recorded history from European settlers, which is, you know, well documented. For example, we know that Walter Mantell was there in 1848 and conducted a census of the population. He found 45 people living there. And so that's quite a bit later, of course, of the period that Ian's talking about. But for our whānau hapū groupings, we know we've got those quite long and ancient connections. And our Māori land block of 206 hectares, now formed into an incorporation, is a tiny fragment of course, the Māori land history. It's all that's left. It was carved out as part of the big Kemp's purchase that happened. Small reserves were established, pretty unsustainable economically at the time. And we know that the legislation of 1967, the Māori Affairs Amendment Act, really put at risk all those individual shareholdings, and so an incorporation was formed. So I've now got, along with a committee, responsibility for the day-to-day management of this tiny sliver running along the coast in an extremely beautiful place, and we're, I guess, asset-rich, cash-poor, but we're holding on for dear life to the, if you like, the historical and cultural value of this remaining fragment of Māori land.
Kia ora. What does the understanding of the find and the dates mean for you, and how significant is it for your iwi's own understanding of its history?
Well, I'm hearing anecdotally feedback from our local Runanga people that they're saying that in terms of oral histories, maps, place names and things, that they kind of had a hunch that this time frame was pretty accurate, and they're now very proud and pleased to see that the research, the very thorough research Ian and his team have done, confirms you know, our own oral histories and narrative. And so what's particularly exciting about this initiative is that emerging partnership between the traditional views and stories about the past and the academically driven research. It's wonderful to see that happening, and we would want to encourage that to continue into the future.
Can you explain more again from Mātauraka, from knowledge, the people's knowledge, your people's knowledge, where these pits would have, what they look like even, and I imagine, you know, again, there's an oral history and an understanding that perhaps informs that, and where they would have sat in the life of the people of the time.
Well, you see, I mean, I can only speak about what I've actually seen, which I've visited the site when Ian has been working there and his people. The knowledge of the time would be of more nomadic lifestyle, of people moving around. But this notion that kumara is stored in one place, and I guess that's an inevitable thing, would have been understood. And perhaps not, though, the accuracy of the dates.
What does it mean for iwi to have now, with the science telling us, with, you know, the ever increasing detail and accuracy, the dates, what does that mean for you And again, for that connection to the land that, as you say, there's only a small sliver left now.
Yeah.
But what does it mean to know this?
It almost feels like it's sort of putting us on the map. You know, the media have been very interested in this and in the fine. It's been a lot of publicity. But there's a conversation happening which perhaps the findings of the research us are clear that without that we wouldn't have had the conversation and the understandings of our place and our history amongst a community, a wider community, which has no awareness of how very long we've been connected with Puakonui and with this particular site.
Kia ora, Nicola. I wonder, Ian, if I could come back to you for a moment. What new research now or extended research will this lead to, or what hypotheses that scientists have been working on will be informed by this?
Well, I think the most important question for me right now is, were those kumara roots, were they produced locally or were they transported over some distance? Now, either of those possibilities theoretically could be the case. My suspicion is that what we might be dealing with here, however, is microclimate production, and I've developed that in the article that published in the Open Access Journal PLOS One that any of your listeners can download for free from the PLOS One website. And in that paper, we've indicated, in fact, that there is a very dark archaeological soil at Puakonui, not far from the archaeological site in the dunes, that may, in fact, have been an original cultivation soil. So it's remarkable that sweet potato were stored down here, given that sweet potato are very sensitive to cold, and we've suggested in the paper ways that they may have been managed, such as placing hot rocks into the pits during colder months to maintain the temperature. But even more exciting is the possibility of microclimate production, kumara production. So that, for me, is the next most important phase of the research, is to see if we can find ways of identifying soils, possible garden soils, and other ways and means of identifying the garden, any possible gardens that may have provided these kumara here. As I say, that they could have been transported down the coast, but we have the opportunity now to test the possibility, I think the very real possibility, that there may have been microclimate production. A couple of other things quickly to say in that regard. The timing of the event as well, the appearance of these pits, is interesting because we know about 1450 CE that moa disappear. So our speculation is that this technology is being introduced in even further south than anyone had taken it previously, perhaps in response to the loss of the important moa food source. The second thing to note is that the technology doesn't continue over time at Puakonui. There is a record of kumara storage, the power site called Huriawa, just about 20 kilometres north of Puakonui in the 18th century. And that's the only oral record I'm aware of that we have of kumara storage. So the second question is, why didn't kumara storage and potentially any microclimate production continue? Now, we know that after 1500 CE, a little ice age impacts the entire globe, including New Zealand. There are climate records that suggest that there are adverse climate impacts of that little ice age. And so we might now have the opportunity to do more work and see if this science can contribute to climate modelling. The final thing I'd just like to say, if I may also, the science is fantastic and we've loved doing it. But for me, just as satisfying is to hear from Nikki and the local Runaka how important this research is for people today, for Kati Huirapa, the Hapu local whānau. For me, that's incredibly satisfying.
That is Professor, Associate Professor Ian Barber from the University of Otago's Archaeology Program. I was speaking there also with Chair of the Puakonui Block, Nicola Taylor, and that research has just been published in the science journal PLOS One.